another edition of WTC. We Talk Comics is back with WTC show 12, is this, guys? Or is it show 13? Should be 13.
Show 12.
It should be 13. We're going to call it show 13 anyways because it's our Geek House of Horror episode. So, therefore, it's the Geek House of Horror show 13. We're cheating. And I'm here again today, once again joined by the spooky Brett. Brett, what's your beef?
What's my beef?
What's your beef?
Well, perhaps the next show should be called 13 and a half, then. That would be along the line of comic book thing. Or perhaps show zero. We never did a show zero, the origin of We Talk.
Either way, your spooky spooky tooth. Your spooky tooth, Brett. Remember that? Still the best name for a band ever. Spooky tooth.
True. And the cheapest thing I've ever purchased, CD I've ever purchased at 39 cents.
Beautiful. And I also have with me the ghoulish Keith. How are you doing, Keith? What's your major malfunction?
Well, I'm looking forward to some talking some comics tonight. I think this should be, we'll call it the next one 13.1, in keeping with
How about we call
Marvel
the next
Boy
one
Flubs.
The new 13, and this will be the old 13. How's that sound?
We'll start our numbering over again.
And, of course, we also, again, have latest member to join the podcast with us here. We got Creepy Chris. Chris, what's your damage?
It's a major malfunction, but I don't quite know what it is.
All right. And, of course, I am the ghastly Mo, as long as ghastly now means incredibly, exceedingly handsome. And we are, of course, as we say, talking. It's going up for Halloween. We're going to talk some history of horror. So I'm going to actually throw it over to Chris, because Chris is probably the most knowledgeable about EC Comics and Bill Gaines and kind of the Seduction of the Innocent and all that stuff. So Chris, why don't you tell us, why don't you fill everybody else in, give us everybody a little bit of backstory on kind of where you know horror comics to have originated from.
Well, I mean, there's always been horror comics, but you're talking about the golden age of horror comics, namely educational comics or entertainment comics. And they started in 1947 when William Gaines inherited educational comics from his father. By 1950, he had three major titles on his hands dealing with horror: Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear.
Haunt of Fear.
These titles...
Sorry. The Haunt of Fear?
Yeah, The Haunt of That's Fear. Cool. They featured work from such visionaries as Harvey Kurtzman, Joe Orlando, and Wally West. And they, quite frankly, were some of the best horror comics ever. Soon, every publisher had 8 or 9 titles trying to compete, but they didn't really ever catch up to what EC was doing.
And this is, of course, where the famous The Tales of the Crypt Keeper originated, before it became an HBO series that was a couple of pretty average movies.
Yeah, Tales from the Crypt, that's what it's based off of. George Romero did a movie. Basically, every horror anthology series is based off what William Gaines put into play. Also, just as a side note, it was the first company ever to encourage a relationship between the creative talent and the fans, with fan letters and actually printing their names in the comic books
That's
themselves.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So we're going to go through here, Brett. What is your thoughts and knowledge of EC?
I think for me, EC comes down to kind of having I love EC for what it stood for, but I don't really enjoy reading EC comics all that much. I think it just comes down to the stories just seem difficult to read in this age. I find because I think that they tend to be a little dated. I love their ironic use of horror, where usually whatever the person is most afraid of is what they get killed by or what have you, but you know, and I certainly think that they have their place, but they're not my favorite thing, but I certainly recognize their value.
Keith, your thoughts?
Well, I've liked various things influenced by EC. Some of the DC work that was kind of short story horror, you know, 8 or 10 page horror stories, and we'll get into some of that later. A lot of it was shock, for sure, and though that's been useful for storytelling techniques, I'm a bit the same as Brett. I've read some. It's interesting as a historical document, but I don't think I'm buying stacks and stacks of them at the shows or anything.
No, honestly, from my perspective, I mean, I remember being 8 and 10 years old and reading reprints of this. And, you know, then I loved them. Now when I've gone back, and I still love the art. I do think the art in that era was a drastic leap forward to what art has become and evolved into, from what major other companies were doing, what a lot of superheroes were doing. The art holds up. The art is still fantastic and inventive and a lot of fun. But the books themselves, yeah, I mean, but the story about EC and the horror comics doesn't just end when you're talking about the quality of them. There's a lot more there. Chris, why don't you continue to fill everybody else in?
You mean on the decline?
On the decline and the reason why, yeah. And also your thoughts on EC, if you have anything personally as well.
Yeah, no, I would disagree with all of you guys that I think a lot of the writing holds up, not all of it. Because we are talking early comics, not a lot of these guys were very well educated, but I mean, some of it was very good. And I think part of your guys' prejudice might be, the anthology. The anthology has never really taken off for anyone in North America. The short tales definitely do hurt it. But oh well, EC sort of came crashing to an end, rather abruptly in 1954, when a book named Seduction of the Innocent was published by Frederick Wilhelm, which brought William Gaines in front of Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency, where William Gaines, and this is where it becomes a hero of mine, he stands in front of Congress and basically tells them like it is that it's a horror comic. If we're going to censor ourselves, this is just ridiculous. The other publishers sort of get together and, oh my God, we can't have government intervention. And they save themselves, and rightfully so. They band together and form the Comics Code. This code is so prejudicial against DC, including several of the titles that they can't use the words terror or fear. Subject matter such as vampires, werewolves, and zombies are no longer allowed to be printed in the comic medium. That EC is basically forced to shut its doors, with the exception of one title, Tales to Calculated to Drive You Mad, which eventually became Mad Magazine.
Interesting.
Other publishers did hold on, however, interestingly enough, without the Comics Code. It was more William Gaines' decision to shut down the EC titles. Dell and Gold Key actually continued to publish horror, just relying on their good Christian values names. But horror after that, until the early 60s, really disappeared for a good 6 years.
Okay, that's awesome, Chris. Very interesting that horror was so incredibly popular. And it didn't almost just shut down EC and horror books. It almost shut down the entire industry. And so did the Comics Code when it first appeared. And, but yeah, I mean, how do you possibly expect them?
Well, Atlas, which became Marvel at that time, was publishing 8 books in the horror genre.
So there,
I think there's 8 Wolverine books now, aren't there?
And many of them are horrific. But, Anyways, it's interesting. It almost caused the comics code and directly came out of this. Now, like you say, William Gaines, he was a hero. Now, my memories of Seduction of the Innocent are largely, remember that little documentary they made where some kid was like sitting underneath a tree and reading an EC book? And then he got up and, like, punched his sister or something like that. It was, like, some ridiculous act of violence immediately came out of reading that book. It was just hilarious. It was one of those 1950s propaganda films.
I've tried to read Seduction of the Innocent just because it is so closely associated with comic books. And it basically, within the first chapter, tells you your kids are going to be perverts, communists, and degenerates of every sort. It is really a book to piss you off.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'd be offended if they were communists. again,
these are the trials that this spawned the trials that eventually took on Hollywood. This was a precursor. This was a test run for those trials.
Excellent, Brett. Your thoughts on Seduction of the Innocent, the Comics Code, and that era.
It's interesting because I'm going to go back and touch on you grabbing values from comic books prior, because if you grab values from, say, Superman, well, according to Seduction of the Innocent, he was un-American and a fascist. So I think that those would be the values, according to Seduction of the Innocent, that you would be grabbing.
They said, Seduction of the Innocent says Superman was un-American. Superman, he's a slice of American pie, really. Created half by Canadian, but he's, you know, slice of American pie, really. Does it actually say that?
Yeah, I believe it does. Again, I mean, it's well, the thing is, though, is that Seduction of the Innocent is essentially just a whole bunch of unfounded reports that this guy just cobbled together to fit his needs. I mean, there's nothing per se true in it, but, you know, hey, it makes a good sensationalized story.
I believe Seduction of the Innocent's problem with Superman was, witchcraft, being his superpowers, and just reckless behavior, kids jumping off roofs and stuff. Basically the same argument we've heard against LSD for the last 30 years without very much
or professional wrestling.
Information.
Incredible.
That's right. No, it's a good time, or professional wrestling. It's one of the great stats that I heard about Seduction of the Innocent is he makes this claim that 90% of juvenile delinquents read comic books. But when you looked at all the stats, it turned out that 90% of kids read comic books. So there was no correlation at all. You know, these days, it's the same as blaming video games now. You know, the same percentages that play video games, period, are going to be reflected in any subset like that.
Yeah.
One doesn't lead to the other.
There's always that grandstanding by politicians to look like they're doing more than they're really doing. And, you know, to try and take something down to make it look like they're trying to influence it. And sometimes I think they believe it, and sometimes they don't. I'm sure some of these politicians believe this book or, you know, didn't understand comic books. Yeah, you know what? This is a really good time to... Brett, what exactly is it that makes you love comic books?
They got nice pictures.
Pretty pictures. All right, well, on that note, let's just move on. And maybe we'll come back to that some other episode when Brett actually has a brain. Actually...
I like when Catwoman and Batman have sex. That's my favorite.
That's what you like?
Yeah,
I'll say this. If Seduction of the Innocent has anything, and young women, say, 18 reading comic books, decide to sleep with me because of it, I'm okay with that. Anyone else?
No, none of us are going to sleep with you.
Keith, you would look fantastic in a Catwoman costume for Halloween.
I would.
Would it stay on?
And the costume stays
on. The costume stays on. All right, so coming out of a Seduction of the Innocent, I'm going to say this. I do think, having read some of those EC books, there's still some of them quite graphic, even for this day and age, even for this era. So, nevertheless, for that era when, I mean, the level of violence in those books in comparison to movies of that era, the level of violence in those books in comparison to, like, if you were to read a horror book today, the level of violence in the horror book, comic book today, is not that different than in the horror movies of today. The level of violence in those horror comic books in the 1950s compared to a horror movie in that era was drastically more graphic. And so the idea of some sort of ratings for comics, I'm never against. I believe there shouldn't be any censorship in what you're allowed to do, but allowing people to make choices. But it was in an era when people panicked, and I think people still panic, as you say, about, I think that was part of Keith's point, that people still panic about things they don't understand. They're new to them.
Well, and I think at the time, comics, and we still get some of this today, comics were only a children's medium from a lot of people's perspective. So why do you need a rating on something that's only for kids anyway? And there are still people that believe this now, that the whole art form not only is for children, but should be for children.
Whereas DC...
that you should actually age out of
DC the apparently believes that they should only be for teens and above.
From their new relaunch. I mean, they do publish Brave and Bold. They do publish a couple other books for kids.
Yeah, because that's what sells. That's their top sellers. Anyways, all right.
Yeah, but I mean, so really, it seems like...
Then that's the fault of the market. That's not the fault of DC.
Wow.
It does seem that DC has books for two books from like 6 to 9 year olds, and then everything else goes at about 14 plus.
Yeah, 60 books, 14 plus. Okay.
Yes, I'd agree that those books in the middle are missing, and I think they're missing everywhere, because I started reading with Power Pack, which was a book that was a real all ages book, and I was 11 when that started. There's no 11-year-old books right now from my perspective.
Okay.
And you can still read that book.
It's a fantastic book. Louise Simonson's, as a side note, she probably wrote children in a more realistic and yet relatable way than any other book I can ever recall. So moving on with the horror. I guess horror books sort of made a bit of a relaunch when they didn't have to be under the comics code when they were black and white books. Leading into the 70s. Does that sound familiar to you, Chris?
Well, to get around the comics code, and actually the first of these were actually reprints of the EZ books in publications like Eerie, they went to a magazine format. And that was merely to get around the comics code. Somehow the comics code didn't apply to the magazine format. I don't know how adding an inch really does that. And advertisers didn't mind. So once again, we could have.
You didn't know how adding. You didn't know, what was that? You didn't know how adding an inch does that. That explains why you're single. Okay, but yeah, so they went black and white. You started to have. You started to have books also then under the comic book authority when they started to have a little more leeway, like Tome of Dracula and that type of thing from Marvel. Marvel, actually, I believe, more so than DC was. Well, DC actually had what? House of... what did they have? House of Mystery
was printed all through this town. But House of Mystery, actually, if you read them, featured more science and mystery stories than actual horror. And Marvel, when they were reintroducing Dracula and their horror books, they always made sure they had an out in case the comics code came calling. Dracula and Frankenstein, they based off of properties so they could retreat to the classics illustrated format. And with books like Blade, they could veer more towards the superhero, sort of getting rid of a lot of the objectionable material.
And what was the thing? They couldn't call him a vampire. Was that the? I know you couldn't talk about zombies.
He was a day.
No.
Was he a daywalker or something like that? Is that what they called? No, that was people that weren't vampires. Daywalkers and nightwalkers.
I think it was that you couldn't refer to somebody as like being undead or dead or something like that. Because I think that it's. Because I think that they were okay calling Morbius the living vampire.
Oh, yes. That's correct.
Did it a lot.
Yeah, I think it was undead, and you could not say zombies, which actually kept going right up until about 5 years ago when Wonder Man got resurrected, and they called him Zombified.
Really?
And
now you have the Marvel Zombie Universe, which is, of course, kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but still, they have all their characters zombie-wise, yeah. So it really has turned around. So when did horror comic books kind of start to make their return and push the boundaries again, Chris, as far as you know?
Push the boundary?
Yeah. When did they kind of start to become popular again?
Well, I think you can actually say probably 2 years ago when
Chris. What about the 90s? You had Evil Ernie and Lady Death and Vampirella. Those were horror comic books and extremely popular.
And any of those Rob Liefeld books.
They're just terrible. They weren't
scared of Jesus.
Scared the hell out of anybody who read them.
Okay,
Chaos Comics.
I was thinking more mainstream, but yes, if you want to go there, the rise of the direct market. You did have the adult books coming in and significant horror books as well. I've just never particularly liked or even classified Vampirella or Evil Ernie or Lady Death as a horror book. It's always been a TNA book.
All right, Keith, you obviously have something you want to say on that. And so do I, but I'm going to let you please lay into Chris a little bit there.
I'm just going to say, as the comics code got watered down, and Chris is right that the direct market is where this really comes out of, but the comics code started losing its teeth as early as the 70s when Stan Lee did Amazing Spider-Man issues without comics code approval on them because he thought the story was worth telling. And that happened a couple of times. It happened with Green Lantern, Green Arrow as well. And then slowly, once the direct market came along, the mature readers label was introduced, and none of those books had a code approval on them. They just had a self-policed label that said mature readers. And once you broke that the comics code no longer meant that you couldn't sell your comic, which is what it was intended to be, is that without that label, it wasn't going to be on newsstands. Direct market didn't care about that. So, and in a lot of cases, sought out books that didn't have the code on.
You know, even a book like Saga of the Swamp Thing would have technically been considered in the 80s a horror book. I don't know if you would call it that, Brett, yourself, but what do you think? Is that technically, do you think it could be classified as the first return to the mainstream of horror books or the most popular and influential horror book of its era?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that you can call it a horror book. I think that Vertigo especially is a really interesting place to go because there's a lot of books there that you know that you might not normally consider them horror, but I think that they certainly can fit within that genre. Like when I think about a horror book, I tend to think about the EC comics. I tend to think about, oh, it's got a zombie in it, therefore it's horror. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that kind of book to still fit within that classification.
Keith or Chris, either of you have anything to say on Brett's comment there?
Yes.
No, I sort of skipped over Vertigo entirely there. I had meant to touch it, and then I skipped over it.
That's
so
fine. We'll get there. Keith, go ahead.
Well, what's a horror book is a bit of in the eye of the beholder. Mo asked us to make a little list up of our favorites, and I'm sure there's going to be books on here on my list that the other guys are going to say, well, that's not really a horror book. Like, why would you call that one a horror? There is a little bit of that. Does it have to be, you know, jump out from behind the tree, scary kind of thing? Or, you know, to look at the new DC stuff, is Animal Man a horror? Is iVampire a horror? Is JLL Dark a horror? There are varying levels of scary, but what do you use as your guidelines?
Yeah, I you know what, it is difficult almost to put a guideline on it. I know a horror book when I read it. Honestly, you know, I don't know a better way to put it. When I read a book and I go, that was a, like, I know it when I read it, but I don't, you know, I can't just quantify, because sometimes there's books which I would call a horror book, right, that aren't scary at all. But that still doesn't mean that's what I think of it as. So let's move on then. So let's say 90s, we had the TNA books, but Evil Ernie, which was just violent. You did have that was kind of the state of horror for a while there, Lady Death and that type of thing. And where are horror books today? I don't know. Who wants to jump in first? And where are horror books today, and where do you see them going? Brett, you want to go first?
Well, I think that there's only one. There is one book right now that that really shapes the face of horror, and that's The Walking Dead. I mean, zombies are such a popular creature right now. Anyways, I mean, look at Marvel with their as you brought up with their Marvel zombie line. But absolutely. I think though that that one of the things that Walking Dead does is that, and I think maybe this is where horror is going, is that it's, you know, the creatures are there not necessarily to, they're just there to constantly be around, and but it's more about the interactions of the people within the book. And so I think that it actually becomes scarier just because of the fact that you don't really know who's going to die at any given time, and that, you know, that it's all, you get to know these people. And I think that maybe horror in the, you know, as we carry on, is going to be more about getting to know the people, and then the outside forces kind of impact that.
Okay, I guess a couple things on that. I think you're right. It's definitely a character-driven book, but that character-driven is still horror-based. Like, it's, but, you know, in The Walking Dead, you say that that kind of shapes things. It does. But The Walking Dead came out about the same time as 30 Days a Night. 30 Days a Night and The Walking Dead, I think, when they first came out, were really about equal in popularity and influence. 30 Days a Night even was made into a film first, and was excellent in its own right, though it's definitely lost some momentum, and probably doesn't hurt that the film as was a little disappointing and led to now a direct-to-DVD sequel. But any comments on that, Brett?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the 30 Days of Night. I just think that ultimately The Walking Dead has more of a long-term feel to me, and certainly the popularity right now is really extraordinary.
Okay, Keith, it's your turn on where horror books are now, where you see them going, and any comments on that last little bit?
It's a fantastic example of Eye of the Beholder, because I'm just finally getting into Walking Dead, and in his introduction to the first volume, Leonard Kirkman says this is not a horror comic.
Robert Kirkman.
Whatever I said before.
You're talking about Leonard Kirk, the artist? Supergirl? Awesome artist. Anyways.
just say Kirkman. Yeah.
So Kirkman, in his introduction, Kirkman says this is not a horror comic. He's very clear that what he wants to tell is a psychological thriller. I'm adding those words, but he ultimately doesn't want to tell a monster of the week, jump out from behind the tree horror story. He wants to tell a different story about how people live in this post-apocalyptic world. So I would call it a horror book, but it's interesting that he doesn't.
Interesting, yeah. Anyways, where do you see horror books today, and where do you see them going?
There's still not a lot of mainstream horror. I mean, I mentioned a couple of books from New 52 that kind of edge on that. Some of them go over, some of them don't. I mean, Animal Man I would put there. Eye Vampire. Animal Man now the surprise hit of the New 52. Number one just went for a third printing.
Excellent.
Which is fantastic. It was one of our picks as the best books, and I think it's the most horror storyline that's going, I think even more than Eye Vampire so far. Swamp Thing, also from that line, that they've actually launched the dark line that is all a bit supernatural in tone. But most horror happens in indies right now. Marvel hasn't, they've toyed with it, they haven't had a lot of success, so they don't go back to that well very often.
Okay. Where do you think they're going in the future?
Well, everything's in cycles. Brett and I kicked around the idea for a short film about 10 years ago, because we looked at everything and said, well, zombies are going to be cool any day now, because we've gone through a Frankenstein phase, we've gone through a vampire phase, then vampires came back, then zombies came back, and it all just comes in cycles. We'll have another mummy phase fairly soon. It's been a few years since the last Mummy movie, so there'll be a new way of looking at mummies. We just had a Wolfman that didn't quite work, so it'll probably be a little while before there's a Wolfman phase, but I guess there's a new TV show of Wolfmen. So.
And Teen Wolf.
And Teen Wolf.
And Teen Wolf. I think there's two different wolves. Yeah, werewolf shows on right now, so it's all cycles.
That's true. That's true. Chris, Creepy Chris, your thoughts on comic or horror comic books today, and where do you see them going?
Yeah, no, a couple of years ago, I thought we were really strong. I thought we were heading for a horror boom. But I think the popularity of The Walking Dead has sort of taken a lot of wind out of the sails. Just having one overwhelming book really kind of hurts the genre of a whole. A lot of stuff can't get off the ground.
There is an element of when you've got something that big, everything else is automatically compared to it. I mean, when we went into reviewing I, Vampire, all of us picked up that book and said, so it's going to be a Twilight-type thing, huh? And it's so not, but Twilight is so overwhelming in its influence on between Twilight and True Blood. We're not right now seeing vampire stories that don't fall into one of those two categories. I, Vampire,
because I don't even know what Steve Niles is doing right now.
He just started.
I don't think he's published anything.
He just the new issue of 30 Days a Night just came out this month. That's a new miniseries drawn by Sam Keith.
That sounds great.
Oh, okay.
That sounds great. Okay, awesome. So let's talk about kind of your first memory of a horror book, Brett.
For me, you know, I guess it's interesting because, again, it falls into that I'm not sure it's horror, but I think it's The Wrath of the Spectre. It's really what I remember reading and really enjoying the type of story, and I think it is in that anthology version. It's very much in that DC vein.
I'm just going to, you know what, Brett? It's one I hadn't thought of, but as soon as you said it, I went, yeah, to me, that's a horror book. Like I said, I know it when I read it. You're right. That does fit to me. And it was excellent.
Yeah, I mean, the Spectre's classed as a superhero, but they definitely put him into those horror situations back then. And I mean, for me, especially as a kid, I love those stories. So,
all right. Keith, your earliest memory of reading a horror and what it meant to you?
Probably would have been Saga of the Swamp Thing that my older brother had. I was very much a superhero reader when I was young. But then the pre-Vertigo mature readers books at DC, certainly Animal Man, once it was no longer Grant Morrison, was playing more in that world. And then around my 20s is really when I started looking at horror books, and Jamie Delano's Hellblazer was those first 40 issues or so of Hellblazer before Ennis took over were so much more of a horror book than where Ennis wanted to go with it.
Excellent. Keith, your earliest horror book memories and what they meant to you. Or not Keith, I'm sorry, Chris. Creepy one.
Okay, I was a little confused there.
You were more than a little confused all day.
Yes. It's been one of those days.
Lives.
But my earliest memories of a horror comic book is probably one of my first memories of comic books in general. A border that my parents had left an old creepy magazine out that I saw. And it was the first time I ever realized that comics could be more than fuzzy bunnies and duckies.
Interesting.
So I guess that's why I am attracted to the EC comic line, is because the first comic images in my head that ever really truly stuck are those ghastly images.
You know what? I wish comics were a little more fuzzy buzzy wuzzies and bunnies and stuff sometimes. That was good stuff.
Yeah, I miss cold-blooded chameleon commandos.
There you go, good stuff. My earliest horror memories, actually, tell you the truth, I guess it would have been an adaptation of what was it, the one that you say Romero and Stephen King, and what was the movie actually called?
Creepshow.
So it would have been an adaptation, and that was just a retelling of tales of the 1940s stories, wasn't it?
They were put in that style that
they were original stories. Okay. Well, that there was a comic book adaptation of that. That was probably actually what I read, not the actual EC books. And I remember reading that as when I was like 8 years old. And,
yeah. Pardon me?
Bernie Wrightson.
That's right. Correct. That was probably what I read. I remember my friends having it and them reading it and thinking it was awesome, me trying to read it. And I finished it, but I kept on reading it going, gotta read it to look like I'm as cool as them, but this is too much for me. It was quite something else. And then, the character that to me I would have, Ghost Rider. Ghost Rider, when it was done right, had a strong horror influence. And, early Ghost Rider, when I read that when I was young also, certainly, and actually probably the best comic book story, horror story I've ever written was a Ghost Rider, that I would consider. But we'll get to that next. Brett.
You've written Ghost Rider? Written.
Well, I have. I didn't publish it because I didn't want to overshadow Marvel. Sorry. Brett, your all-time favorite series or individual horror stories?
Well, I guess, currently right now it is Walking Dead. I love the book. I think that if I may be so bold as to call it horror against Kirkman's wishes, but, I think that what it does with the characters is amazing. And it's one of those few books that actually does manage to keep me on the edge of my seat wondering what the hell is going to happen. I mean, there's a lot of other books that I do really enjoy. I mean, I think that, Neil Gaiman's certainly written a bunch of books that can be classed in that. Alice Cooper's Last Temptation could be classed in that horror vein. Of course, the Hellblazer stuff, Sagitt the Swamp Thing, all great books in that. But, Vertigo just has so many horror books in that regard. You know, I mean, you could almost call Ted McKeever's The Extremist a horror book to a certain degree, so.
All right, Keith, your favorite individual stories or series for horror comics?
This was a tough one for me because I am such a Vertigo fan, and they have done so many. So trying to get outside of Vertigo, I picked a couple. From Hell.
Oh, yeah.
Warren Campbell. A series called Negative Burn. It was an anthology, but a lot of them were horror-themed stories. As well as a DC fairly short-lived anthology series called Wasteland. Del Stone wrote a lot of those. And interesting stuff. It didn't last very long, 16 or 18 issues or something. And the book that I fell in love with Warren Ellis is writing on Hellstorm.
Mm.
Such really cool art. He had talked about, there was talk about bringing it back. It just never happened, unfortunately.
You mean Druid doesn't count?
I had actually forgotten all about Druid. That didn't last very long. That was kind of, it was a shot at rebooting that whole thing, but would he get four issues, three issues?
Druid
like
was
that?
Just a mini series.
I believe it was four.
I thought it was a
mini.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
Wasn't it a mini?
I don't think it was intended as a mini. But I'd have to look. I think it wasn't actually intended to be a mini.
I think it might have been one of those that they started it, like the first issue was designed as the regular series, and then they realized that the sales were so poor that it suddenly became a mini series.
Good read, though.
Yeah, and that was right around the time that Marvel made another go in the late 90s at a horror line, and it lasted a very, very short time, I think 6 or 7 months total, where they did... Paul Jenkins was doing Werewolf, DeMatteis was doing Man-Thing, and...
The Man-Thing was great.
It was the Strange Tales line. That Man-Thing was great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Unfortunately, neither book lasted very long. They tried to combine them into one book just called Strange Tales, which only got two or three issues out, and then Man-Thing's story, it gets wrapped up in a Spider-Man annual or something, just to close it out, just to use up the pages.
I believe that was DeMatteis,
yeah,
wasn't
DeMatteis,
it?
Said,
it
yeah.
was indeed. Yeah.
It was mm-hmm. great stuff.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Yeah, and Liam Sharp.
Yes, that's right, Brett. Yeah, and Liam Sharp's Man Thing was awesome.
It was beautiful.
Your favorite, all-time favorite, Chris, Creepy Chris.
Okay, I've got a couple here. I've tried to depart from the regular pathways. Joe R. Lansdale, let's go with him. We have Dead in the West, we have Dead Folk, we have the three Jonah Hex series that really tried to broaden westerns into the horror genre, which all are great.
A lot of humor in them, but they're also definitely horror tinged.
Oh, yeah. I went with some humor here, too, with a book I know we all love, Johnny the Homicidal Maniac. You may not call it horror, but if you aren't a little bit horrified with yourself after reading it, I probably don't want to know you.
That's true. That's true.
Another book being written right now that I am really enjoying the artwork as well as the story, Amazons versus robots versus
robots versus zombies.
Zombies, yeah. Versus robots versus zombies.
Is that the Ashley Wood series?
Yes.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I love his stuff.
Okay, awesome. Is that it, Chris?
Yeah, that's my list. Wanted to go with the Warren Ellis stuff, but people already took that
that's
away.
All right.
You knew that Keith was going to jump on that
every
one.
Single book.
Oh, yeah, and I was hoping he
every
would.
Single book and series you guys have recommended, I hope people consider going tracking down and reading. A couple of my favorites, again, is it or isn't it that horror? Well, I would say Hellshock Volume 2, when it got to that, I considered it to be a horror book. And I thought it was as good a series art-wise and story-wise as I had read in that era. You know, there's obviously was issues in the publication of it, and I never did even finish as it wrapped up because I kind of just lost it for me. But that to me, when that came out, it was such a departure from the first series, which was a definite superhero book, that it... it shocked me, and I thought it was just amazing. Joe R. Lansdale, Chris mentioned one of his. I'm going to mention another one called The Drive-In that I thought was an excellent horror book that he did, independently published. I'll talk about my all-time favorite horror story, though, being Ghost Rider, issue 68 from Volume 2, written by Roger Stern. I guess it doesn't hurt to do a spoilers for a book that is published 30 years ago, so I'll just jump into it. Essentially, it's a retelling of his origin. And what it is Johnny Blaze goes to a confessional and retells his tale to the priest. And it turns out the reason he's there is because this man has killed the priest and is pretending to be a priest who's a murderer who's gotten away. And he's there as a spirit of vengeance, to take vengeance upon this man pretending to be the priest. So the framing story is incredible, as is the origin, and then the chase and the vengeance that is given. That was something else. It is my all-time favorite horror book, number 68, Ghost Rider. Unfortunately, it might not mean as much to you now, because you won't get that twist ending that I got when I was a child, read it. But no book has ever stayed with me more, and definitely... the art style and the presentation, if you read it, is definitely a horror book to me. So, all right, guys, that's excellent. Let's get into reviewing really quickly the three books that were sent to us in digital previews. And thank you to the people who forwarded it to us, as well as to you, Keith, for helping hook us up with that. Let's go outside of the horror really quickly, because there's three books, and two of them are horror-related, and one isn't. Let's just knock the horror one off first. Comic Book Junkie, and we'll start with Chris this time, go in reverse order, let him get a little bit of shine. Chris, what did you think of the book Comic Book Junkie?
Actually, it reminded me of the 90s. I really enjoyed it. I could have used a little bit more story, but the characters were relatable. And the art style reminded me of Clerks or a little bit of Batman the Animated Series. Nice. Square, blocky, easy to understand. Once again, characters I knew. Not a book that I'd give to a newbie, but I think anyone who's been around comic books for a while will really enjoy this book.
Okay, Keith, why don't you tell us about Comic Book Junkie? Actually, maybe to fill in people a little bit on what it's about as well while you're at it. Or should I, Chris, do that? But it's too late now.
Well, Comic Book Junkie is really about the early 90s speculator time in the comic book industry. And it's just a short adventure of a guy who makes his living off of the speculator market and he's trying to get back a pile of comic books that someone has taken from him because he needs them for a comic show that weekend. Just a fun little book, and particularly for three of the four of us worked in comic stores in the 90s.
The other one was all the time, and, Chris.
And the other one just wandered back and forth between your store and my store.
Hey, I also hung out at other stores.
This would be true, folks.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, it very much captures that time, that era of the comic industry. And it reminded me a lot of Slacker, actually, which is a comic we've talked about before on here. It's just that the overall attitude, it's a different attitude than hipsters. It's far more sarcastic, far more self-aware. I was certainly of that. That character could be me, only I wasn't as well armed.
Thank God for that. Brett, your thoughts on Comic Book Junkie?
Well, it's I totally agree with the attitude of the book. I definitely love the attitude of the characters, and I love the fact that they're putting a comic book in that 90s speculative market, because that is an era that it was so crazy to be part of comics in that era, and there's no question about it. Now, the story itself, I'm not going to say, like, obviously I was never involved in any type of thing, and I've owned a comic book store.
With enough armament to take on Iraq, you mean?
Yeah, and the concept that every one of them had girls, I mean.
That is stretching reality a little, isn't it?
We knew guys with that many guns in that era.
Well, were you a guy with that many guns, a guy with that many girls? But I don't think any of them ever were anywhere near each other.
Yeah, they weren't. So, I mean, there's parts to the story that just didn't quite work for me in that regard. But the art style, it definitely reminded me of a Jim Mahfood kind of thing. The guy who did Clerks for Kevin Smith there. And so I totally dig the art style. And I really think that it's got a lot of potential. Here's Brett being the crazy guy who's going to bring up lettering again. It could use a little help in the lettering, because a couple of them are nicely lettered, and then a couple of them are really tightly lettered. It's just something I see to
know. You know what? I think that these folks, they want constructive criticism. And there's nothing wrong with giving that. I think the art style, definitely you pick it up and you can see this is an independent book. It feels like an independent book. The characters aren't particularly likable. But you know what? That's not necessarily in this case a bad thing. Most of the time I think it is. But in this case, they're trying to do a very, very dark book. They're trying to capture that. And they did it well. I think if I had one thing that I wish that it had, I think is a little bit too inside. I think if you weren't reading books in 1994, 90% of this goes over your head. And so I think it's just a little bit too much for the hardcore fan. I appreciated that. I got the references that they're making, but I think it's just a little bit too much in that. And I think that that's one thing that they could work on. But a good book. I wouldn't call it a comedy. Unless you call it a black comedy, but there's definitely a lot of humor there. It's funny because it's one of those books, I'm not sure where I'd classify it, because it's too dark to be a regular comedy, maybe even too dark to be a black comedy, but definitely a lot of humor there. I don't know. Keith, what would you say?
I just wanted to wrap up thanking George Chase for this book. He's the creator of Comic Book Junkie, hypnocomics.com, GeorgeChase1 on Twitter. And for Brett, what you were saying about lettering, there was a day about a week back, so go through Chris Eliopoulos' Twitter feed. He spent about 3 hours talking about lettering. About every 5 minutes, there was a new, and this is how you are a professional letterer. I need to grab all that before it disappears off Twitter and just throw it into a Word document, because it was brilliant. It was just such an insider look at.
It could have been, he could have charged for that.
Yeah, that's all done.
It could have been a course.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was cool. I remember you saying to everybody, follow with it if you're not reading his tweets that day. And I remember going and checking them out based on you saying that, which is weird because usually when you tweet, I ignore it. Let's move on to the next one. Byron. Chris, your thoughts on the book Byron.
I liked it. However, it reminded me of everything else that Slave Labor Graphics has ever published other than Slacker. Sort of had a Johnny the Homicidal Maniac feel. That said, the art was fantastic. Once again, story, I definitely want to read a second issue, but I don't know how much further I'm going to take it further than that.
Okay. Keith, your thoughts?
It was an interesting book. I really like the cover of this book. Some of the stuff we've been looking at doesn't necessarily have the strongest covers. I did like the one on Comic Book Junkie. I like the one on this. I did have to read it a second time before I really had a good feel for the story, because there is quite a bit that happens. I don't want to give too much away, because in this case, I do worry about spoiling. But it is available digitally on Slave Labor's website, as they're launching their digital only for single issues. And I thought there was a clever twist fairly early on in the story, when one of the characters is killed and goes to heaven, and what she's told at the pearly gates gave me a bit of a giggle. Where it goes near the end kind of meandered a bit for me, but I thought there was some cleverness in the premise of it.
Brett, Spooky Tooth.
Well, I'm good. I'm going to agree with a couple of things that the fellows have said. Again, I really enjoyed the art. I definitely, I enjoyed that style, and I totally agree that it strikes me as a total Slave Labor book. You know, it's got that, because I was also reminded of another series that they did, Lenore, that just that very dark kind of art. But, you know, like, there is some good parts in the story. It does, to me, it totally, like, dips down into these moments where it's just kind of like, okay, I'm not really with you at this point. And then it brings me up, and I'm like, oh, okay, now I'm with you. And then now I'm not so much with you. But I think at the end, I definitely have an interest in reading another one. So I look forward to seeing where they take the story, for sure.
Okay. I think the Lenore comparison is very good. I really, really, really liked this book an awful lot. I thought I liked the art. This book, it's funny because Keith said that a lot happened, and I'm going, almost nothing happened. And that's kind of a lot happened while nothing happened. And that's what I like. There's a point in this book where it's just two characters talking to each other and not going anywhere, and it goes on and on and on. And normally I would have hated that because nothing's happening. The plot's not moving forward. It's just these characters talking back and forth. But I love the dialogue, and I was so amused by it, and I so enjoyed the characters so much that I didn't bother me. I was like, I could read these two characters talking to each other all day. And then finally one other character pops up, and, you know, because I'm still here type thing. And my only issue is I don't think in this entire book we found out who the hell Byron is. No character named Byron makes it a mention. I think they say the name Byron a few times, but nobody named Byron shows up or anything like that. So that's the one thing I was confused about. But other than that, I love this, and I think this is going to be a fun series for people who want something a little quirky and a little different, and who are like character-driven, funny stuff that is something that they can enjoy. So I hope everybody gives this one a shot. Byron, Slave Labor Graphics. I'm pronouncing that like Chris would, but I. Who was the creator of this book, Keith? Do you want to give a shout-out to them at all? You have it there? You had it for the last guys.
Carl Christian.
Carl Christian?
Carl Christian.
Christian. Good name. My dad's name is Carl Christensen. So, okay, interesting. All right, let's move on to the last one. Chris, our final book, another horror-themed book that Byron sort of fits in the horror theme. And was that you sighing?
No, that was me sighing.
That was you sighing. Runner.
Yeah, no, I was hoping not to get the first one on Runners.
No?
This book wasn't my cup of tea. Story-wise or art-wise, the art had a lot of problems with perspective. I will say the inker on this book is a hero. Saved a lot of the art. that the inker, it would have been impossible to understand without the inker shading some of it. That's as far as I really want to go into Runners.
Okay, Keith, your thoughts on Runners?
There was things I liked in it for sure. It was an interesting mashup of styles, of storytelling styles, I should say. I will say I didn't care for the cover on this, and I do see this a lot on indie books, that the interior artist isn't necessarily the best person to be working on the cover. And even when you look at mainstream books, a lot of times you will have cover artists that aren't the one doing the inside art because they have a special skill of doing those striking, eye-catching images. And either, you know, people like Alec Ross that just take so long, or Brian Boland, whose work is so detailed.
Specifically,
as well.
What didn't you like about the cover?
It is, like all the art in the book, it is, for want of a better word, what you think of when you think of 90s indie comics. A bit simplistic in the style, a bit open. Cartoony is not the right word, but just a bit of air in the art style.
Okay.
I thought the storyline was interesting, though. The direction that the book goes, and it's a take I don't think I've seen before. A zombie book paired with another genre. And I liked that the postscript in the book does just say right out, yes, I know that there's some similarities to Walking Dead. That's just the way it is. And any zombie book is going to be compared to Walking Dead, like we were saying earlier.
Your thoughts on Runners?
You know, again, the postscript totally sold me on the entire book. When I, like, as I was reading the book, I was definitely questioning it because it was like, wow, this is really close to The Walking Dead. And I wasn't sure that I was in there with the other thing. And then I read the postscript, and so I kind of went back through it, and I looked at it with kind of fresh eyes, and so I totally appreciated the storyline in that regard, and I definitely think that it fits nicely with The Walking Dead, so I do look forward to it in that regard. I also agree, though, that the art really reminds me of that, like, 90s independent young artist kind of thing where, you know, they haven't quite gotten the human anatomy down yet, and so there needs to be some work with that. Completely agree as well with the cover. The cover, if I saw that cover on the stands, I would probably pass this book over very quickly.
I think, Brett, what you said to me when I first said this is one of the books and you opened it up, you just saw the cover, you said, oh, this doesn't look good. But, you know, that's why you got to read them.
Well, absolutely, but that's also, it really speaks to, like, how that cover absolutely needs to grab you, because I think that the story is worth it once you get into it, and that's where if there was that one cover that totally sucked you in, then I think you'd be willing to accept, like, growing pains in the internal art style.
Yeah, it's actually interesting, the cover, because I looked at it and thought, on the one hand, it gives away nothing, on the other hand, it gives away too much at the same time. And it's just not very interesting. But once I got inside, whereas I really, 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 really liked Byron, I absolutely loved this. I mean, I loved this book. This would be a bag, and better than any 52 as far as I was concerned. Yeah, there was some issues where there was some points where the female characters looked far too muscled and masculine compared to what they did a panel before. But as far as being able to flow, as far as how well the book flowed and the storylines, and keep in mind we got a digital preview given to us as a PDF version, so it's a little bit different to read. I had no trouble reading the book as far as our style, and I can see the artist working on it and potential. And as far as the concept, the dialogue, I enjoyed the dialogue. The characters, there's twists, there's intrigue. I don't know where they're going, but I think I know where they're going, but I'm not sure, so that makes me want to read more. Character's interesting. Concept, just extremely interesting concept. That I can't believe somebody hasn't done before. And I just loved it. So, there we go. Please check out. From, I believe it's Comics Tribe. Is that the publisher?
You betcha.
That's right, comicstribe.com, and Tyler James Comic on Twitter is the guy who sent it to us. Greatly appreciate
that. Thank you very much, Tyler James. Yeah.
I don't think anyone actually ever mentioned the title of the
Runners,
book.
About seven Runners. Times.
Oh.
And it's created by Stephen Forbes, who's the writer, and Mac Radwanski is the artist, and Vic Moya is the inker.
And, yeah, Runners. Excellent. I thought it was tremendous. So, all right, terrific, guys. Any last thoughts on horror or anything else you want to add or plugs? Let's go through again and give Brett the first shot.
One of those last little things that I'm going to mention that I just kind of forgot about earlier was another anthology series called Flowers on the Razor Wire. Another one of those kind of odd ones that you know, some of them are quite horrific in their own way, and some of them, so, you know, it doesn't quite fit with your typical version of horror, but it's a pretty good anthology if you like some creepy stuff. Otherwise, you know, we're progressing along with everything else. It's a super busy time, so we're just trying to get everything out.
All right, Keith, your thoughts?
It was interesting trying to put together
and
a list
plugs,
of...
And plugs, because Brett didn't plug his email.
And plugs. I guess Mo's flipping the lights on and off. He wants us to wrap this all up. The Creature Commandos was a book that came back to me as the rest of you were talking. Not the modern one, the old weird war tales stories. And I'm curious to try out some of the newer Creature Commandos books, having, you know, fond memories of those. And one of the other books that I wasn't sure whether it should go on the list or not is Batman Arkham Asylum. It's a dicey
one. Oh, my God, you just caused me to remember maybe my favorite that I forgot.
Well, you can put it into yours then. For plugs, I'm on Twitter, CubReporterK, now being hassled constantly for my opinions. I'm writing for thecorrectness.com. We're doing the Action Smackdown going on right now every Friday.
Excellent. And why don't you throw up Brett's contact information since he...
So Brett at wetalkpodcast.com and Keith at wetalkpodcast.com. I've yet to get a viewer, a listener email, so I would love one. I would treasure it. I would read
frame
it.
You're going to print it and frame it.
Definitely read it online, folks, and then we'll edit it out later. No, seriously, we do want to hear from everybody. We want you. We absolutely want that. And it's also Brett_WeTalk on Twitter for him, folks. Chris, final thoughts, plugs, anything you have?
Well, the only book I'm reading right now, trying to catch up on the Mike Carney Lucifer, kind of enjoying it, not really decided yet if it's quite up to its lineage of the Sandman. And I can be reached at chris@wetalkpodcast.com.
I'm Mo at wetalkpodcast.com, and I'm Mo_wetalk on Twitter. Next month, folks, Small Press Month. So fans of Small Press books, every episode we're going to – this. We talked about some Small Press books here – but we're going to talk about a Small Press book and try and highlight a publisher and a series or two every single episode next month that we do. So it's Small Press Month for November, and hopefully an annual tradition for We Talk Comics. So please, if you're a Small Press publisher or a fan of a particular book or just about to publish and do your own book and you're looking for either an interview or simply to send us a preview copy for us to review and talk about and hopefully help you guys out with, that would be excellent. Other than that, I really have nothing to say except for I almost forgot to mention Batman Red Rain. I love that. Batman, Elseworlds book, Kelly Jones, art who I didn't appreciate on Batman regularly, so well suited to this. I believe Doug Monch, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but Doug Monch, Mensch, however you pronounce his name, I believe he was the writer on it.
I thought it was Monk.
Maybe it is Monk. Perhaps it's one of those names that's a little difficult. It's not quite that Fabian whatever. I'm not going to even try it. Brett can fill it in for me later. But Batman Red Rain, where Batman ended up becoming a trilogy, hardcover Elseworlds novels. He's a vampire, and I thought that was wicked. So I'm going to throw that in there. And definitely, I think, fits into the horror category. All right, folks. Brett, I think it's your turn for the actual sign-off. before we go, O-U-T.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.